The objective of my talk this morning is just to perhaps give our understanding of some of the proposals. What I'm saying today is in detail in the document that has been circulated to the members of Parliament. It's informed by the proposals that Treasury has put through, and we also took into consideration the public hearings and the workshops that we attended by Treasury. So essentially what we got from the workshops in particular was that, yes, it sounded like there had been prior consultations with stakeholders, but it was surprising to us that there were still very different views between...
I hope you're listening, right? Okay. Because this is the Parliamentary Budget Office, and they're independent, they're not linked to the ANC, and so on. I see a little to do with them about coming on the board. But as I see country advisors, I don't think that they're bigger than the country.
I was. I am a former lecturer.
You became lecturer young, but nevertheless. So you Yeah.
I'm having this problem getting old. Right. Okay. Sorry. Thank you for reminding me. Right. Can we go on? Sorry. You think the ANC has got tensions? Look at the tensions in this committee. Right. Can we move on?
Okay. As I was saying, we noted that there were still very different views between the various stakeholders and the proposals put forward by the National Treasury. And to take into consideration the level at which the proposals are at now, being in Parliament, we thought it would be useful to have another look at the processes followed with stakeholder engagement, so that by the time that the proposals reach Parliament, the fundamental issues would have been ironed out, particularly with the practical application of the proposals. I appreciate that it would be very difficult to reach consensus between National Treasury and the relevant stakeholders, given the separate or different interests with regards to tax policy, but the level of differences was worth noting. The next point that we wanted to talk to is just the sufficiency and the relevance of the research behind the proposals. We thought that it is very important indeed to note international experiences, but we also thought that, or at least we got a sense that the South African specific case was not sufficiently considered in certain cases. Also consideration of unintended consequences, the impact on the affected taxpayers affected by the proposals. We're just wondering if there's enough education to those taxpayers. It was evident that certain taxpayers already made decisions based on the proposals, but the fact of the matter is that the proposal is still proposals, it's not yet law. So we thought that it would be very important, again, to expand on stakeholder engagement, educate the affected stakeholders before people take life-changing decisions based on just a proposal. The other issue that we noted is the issue of effective dates. There was quite a bit of a pushback with regards to effective dates, particularly on anti-avoidance measures. We appreciate that because of the nature of an anti-avoidance measure, it is important to put into effect the proposal as soon as possible. At times, that unfortunately results into retrospective application. But there was one proposal that essentially had application, it effectively gave effect to the proposal to transactions dating back to as far back as January 2016. Now, if in the ordinary course of business, people make decisions, based on the legislation as it stands, and then subsequently there are proposals and amendments to the legislation that date back as far as the 2016 budget speech. It begs to ask the question, is that fair, and does that give certainty to the tax legislation? I think at this point I'll just leave it at that. We did not want to go into the detail of the tax proposals, partly because when we attended the workshops, it was clear that there would be subsequent consultations with stakeholders, which have the likelihood of changing the proposals as they would be presented by National Treasury this morning. Okay, thanks.
Can you give us an overview of what happened at the workshops, basically? I thought you were going to assist us with ideas on tackling the content issues, but you said nothing in that regard. And when is that going to happen?
Chairperson, as I indicated, that we did prepare a report which does go through the major issues that we picked up from the workshops. If you would like for me to go through that, I can go through at least four issues that we picked up. The major one was the repeal of the exemption on the foreign employment income. What came out of that is that mainly the unintended consequences. Firstly, it was the issue of, do people really understand what is meant by tax residents? A lot of people don't really understand that the tax residents definition is not really the same as being a citizen. So as we know, South African residents or tax residents, South Africans are taxed on their worldwide income. So regardless of where you earn your income, you will still be taxed on your worldwide income. But now what came out of that, Treasury will indicate in detail the effect of these proposals. What would happen then is that if somebody earns income from a foreign source because of employment, they would be taxed in South Africa because they are tax resident, but they may be subjected to tax elsewhere. And because of that, Section 1010 exempted taxpayers from the income that they earn in the foreign jurisdiction. But now Treasury is proposing that to be in line with the worldwide income taxation, because of the residence-based taxation that we follow, we do away with the exemption and include that foreign income in the taxable income of the resident taxpayer. I think for me, what came out of that was just the considering whether the resident test is sufficient in line with the physical presence test and the natural residence test. Also, the timing, I think, of the provision. There are people who made decisions to earn foreign income given the legislation as it stands. I appreciate that the proposal is not going to be immediately effected, but there are people who are already in long-term contracts. What are we saying about them? And can we consider slowly putting the provision in place, not just at the same time? And also considerations on the threshold. The reality is that most people who work abroad are low-earning income people. So these are your nurses, your teachers, and the rest of it. So can then we consider having a threshold of saying you will still be given the exemption if you earn this much, and if you earn beyond that, then the exemption is taken away. So that was that. And also the one last thing on that is the tax deductions. We have different tax deductions in different jurisdictions. So, for example, certain people contribute towards social contributions in other jurisdictions. How then do you factor that in when calculating the tax payable by the tax resident now, if you take away the exemption? I guess, again, also it would be an issue of do we have sufficient systems in place on the tax administration side, the refunds. We have the tax ombuds report now making the rounds. Are we not then setting ourselves up for similar outcomes? And then the next issue that was topical at the workshops was the tax relief for bargaining councils. I think what we noted predominantly on that was why the special treatment to bargaining councils? Why do bargaining councils not just make use of their normal SVDP or VDP? Why are they now being given special treatment? I think the reasoning behind that was that the reason we got from Treasury from that is that the bargaining councils will go under if they go through the normal SVDP. I guess what we missed from that was just the reasoning behind saying they would go under. Okay. Chair, I think let me stop there. As I said, the detailed report will give you more detail on what issues to consider. Okay.
What we would like, obviously, is not for you to just give us an account of what came out of the workshop and your understanding of the issues from the workshop. It's your independent research. What are you suggesting? Are the issues that the committee needs to take into account in making its decisions on specific provisions in the bill? That's the mandate, as I understand. So presumably when we come back, we'll have something of that substantial sort. Thank you.
Right. Over to you, Treasury. Then we will allow the stakeholders to respond briefly, and then we will allow you to respond, and then we decide how we go forward. In the meanwhile, there are two issues. The one which, once we get a quorum, maybe we can look at. But after yesterday's meeting, I think we have now one more member in the call. After yesterday's meeting, I realized I've been sent email while we were here in the meeting on the MAFR report, which was very impractical. They came from Sakele, and there's one point made by Tepoho. So I've made two further amendments. They're very minor. According to Advocate Jenkins, you don't need to vote again on the report, but we can go the safe route and vote again on it, but I'll take you through. That'll take us 3 minutes. There's nothing controversial there. Thank you. But remind me, the other point I need to make is that I engaged with Tandi last night. I have to leave at about 11:30, 11:45 to be elsewhere, and Tandi will take over because she's experienced with tax bills. And then we also got an emerging resident expert here. He's emerging for too long, but tax is going to become his area, Derek Hanekum, so beware. Right? He's got the clout that Tandi and I don't have, and that Tandi once had.
Okay, over to you, Momo and your team.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Chair, I think we'll respond to, and get to the first slide, to the more specific issues that Gloria has raised. As we get to the issue, but let me just make some general points. I think, Chair, just to remind ourselves, what we're doing today is, of course, having published the bill in July, on the 19th, having come to present, having had the hearings, having had the workshops, today we're coming to present our draft response. And I say draft because it's not sort of been approved by the minister. And even I think for us this time round, just given the parliamentary cycle, we were happy that you're having the hearings. But it's been quite a rush for us, I think, to complete our processes to have the hearings. So there may be, I think, one or two issues we may still want to just do some work on, because bear in mind this is a draft response we then finalize the actual, or we firm up the changes into the bill itself, which will then be tabled, and that's what you would be looking at. Chair, the point that I want to make is that one shouldn't be surprised by differences. And I think that if we ever anticipate and say that through the consultation processes or the workshops there must be agreement.
But where do you get agreement on tax anyway in the world?
Precisely.
You've covered that point, Momo.
Yeah, I know, Chair, we have, but it's been raised, so I have to respond, okay? No, not by you, but sorry, please, I'm not pointing at you.
Yes, sir, we understand, okay?
But I think I do need to say that if players know that there must be agreement, you can be certain there will be no agreement because it's a delaying tactic.
And reduce the gaps,
okay.
And create better understanding.
And I think understanding what the differences are is maybe more important, but it does involve a judgment call. So ultimately, you have to accept our judgment call or not, or amend it, and that's what we're doing today. So I'm not too fussed about differences. I think if you go to workshops, you'll find they are quite robust at the best of times. So that shouldn't surprise you, I think, anybody at all. I think, Chair, on the issue of, yes, a lot of people have responded. I think concepts like citizenship versus tax residency, domicile, emigration, immigration are very hard concepts. And for ordinary people to understand how it affects them, especially, as we've said, when we have proposals that affect the individual taxpayer, you can change the medical credits. So, Lisa, I owe you something. I've forgotten that. I must come back to it. The thing is that no, when members write to us in query, we always reply. But the issue, I think, is that, you know, people obviously don't have tax advisors and will just read popular versions in the newspapers and get excited, or worse, only get to know about it after the law has taken effect in 2 years' time, okay? So certainly, I think, on the foreign tax income exemptions, etc., I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding, no doubt, and I think we take the point that we do need more and better communication, but I promise you, even if we did that, it's going to be very hard to reach out to people. But I'm hoping that today, as we discuss the changes that we've proposed, that will kind of bring some relief. I don't think we're aiming for all those doctors or nurses or teachers who go overseas and teach. We do want the maths teachers to stay here, but and the doctors to stay here preferably, but to the extent that they go, you certainly don't want to hit the kind of incomes below, say, a certain threshold. I think just the last issue on retrospectivity, that's also always an issue. Most times when the minister announces, some things take effect as and when he announces. Yes, we have to announce dates. As you know, for example, for the change in the withholding tax on dividends, it had to take effect immediately. Otherwise, people game the system. And hence it takes effect immediately, and we've gone into the issues that it takes effect before the law actually is passed. And what you understand by retrospectivity, we take anti-avoidance measures. It normally is on the date that we announce something. And yes, Chair, sometimes it's a game of bluff. We have to announce it that it will be there. We have to have deliberate uncertainty. You know, like central bankers have, what's it, Chris? Constructive ambiguity. We need that. It is a game we've got to play. Otherwise, people are going to structure. So for as long as they don't know until the law is passed, it helps. So I would just say those are par for the course. We'll deal with the specific issues on the on the specific proposals and issues as they arose at the workshop, Chair. So we will sort of deal with that. So, Chair, I think today, if we move on to the next slide. So if you look today we're dealing with, obviously, so the Foreign Employment Income Exemption, the repeal, we're dealing with that. We will deal with bargaining councils. Those are the big issues. I think those are amongst the biggest issues. Share buybacks is an important issue. But let us just go through the issues in terms of our response. As you know, Chair, we've got so this draft document which goes and attempts to look at all the comments that we've received. We take every comment that we receive. We like to think that we take everyone into account. There's too many to deal with these individually, so we try and take them as themes. We also publish a list of all the people who have submitted comments, either directly to the Treasury and to Parliament. That list is not here yet, is it?
It's there.
Okay, it's coming out, yeah. So you'll get that as well, and we'll then just present some of the key issues that are outlined in this document. That's what we're doing in the presentation. Do you want to kick off? Who, Yanga or France?
Thanks. So the first one is really on the Foreign Employment Income Exemption. So this slide, we just tried to show how many comments we got. So we got 1,308 distinct comments from individuals on this proposal. A lot of those were written and took a lot of time that for people to actually write those submissions separately, so it was a lot to go through. We did go through them all, so just to try and give the committee some comfort that we did. We've got a table there that shows all the different issues and how many of the respondents spoke about each issue. So, for example, the impact, the financial impact, 760 people said that they would have a very severe financial impact. 866 said that, what about the cost of living in foreign jurisdictions? 1,060 said, but there's poor employment prospects in SA, so that's why we have to go offshore. 1,041 said, if this tax comes in, we're not going to send as much money back to South Africa. 763 said SARS didn't have the capacity to do this. So these are all the issues that were brought up, and we've dealt with the main issues in the draft response document. Just to focus on some of the wider issues as well, it was economic concerns about remittances, retirement savings, employment prospects, high costs. In terms of where it came from, it was predominantly from the Middle East, the UAE, Kazakhstan, Oman, Qatar, where those countries have very low tax rates in those countries, so that the impact that would be on those individuals would be quite severe, which we spoke to the committee about previously. But there were also quite a few comments from higher tax countries, such as the UK, but not that many from Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Although in the original proposal, if you were a South African tax resident in those higher tax countries, you would still have had to pay a top-up payment to SARS because our tax system is more progressive than in those higher tax countries. And it's predominantly people in professional services industries such as finance, a lot in the social services industry. So as was said before, teachers, nurses, security especially as well. And an interesting point that was noted was that the average time abroad was 7 years. Everybody told us how long they had been abroad. And a lot of those, the average is only 7, but a lot of them were, say, 15, 12, 13 years, yet they were still seen as South African tax residents, and they hadn't ever formalized their tax affairs and told SARS that they were non-tax resident. And so that's just a background in terms of all the comments that we received. So just to get into the specific ones and our responses. So the first one is the tax will have a severe negative impact on our finances and remittances. What about living costs? We're not going to be able to support people at home or support businesses in South Africa. So this was the main issue. What about the impact? And what about those on lower to middle income classes? So we've said here that we've accepted that proposal. So the main change to this proposal that we would like to make is that we would like to put in an exemption threshold of 1 million rand so that the first million that you earn in foreign employment income, foreign remuneration, would be exempt, and then you would start having to add to taxable income in South Africa any income you earn above a million. So for example, if you didn't have any taxable income in South Africa, if you earned 1,100,000, you would put 100,000 in as taxable income in your tax return to SARS. And the first 75,000 of that is actually tax-free because it's according to the progressive income tax schedule. So you will also get the benefit of starting from zero if you have no other taxable income in South Africa. But now that still needs to only apply, so we need to keep the 183-day rule. So we can't get rid of the 183-day rule because then if we didn't, some CEOs might go overseas for one day and earn a million and then come back. So we have to keep the 183-day rule, but then if you are outside of the country for more than 183 days, then the first million will be exempt. So we think that this really should address a lot of the concerns on the impact to lower and middle class individuals who go overseas looking for work, the nurses, the teachers, the security guards that are overseas. It should really help them. The other big important point is that if you're in a higher income tax country, such as the UK or Australia or New Zealand, if you apply this exemption, there shouldn't be any top-up that you need to pay to SARS. So in effect, this excludes a lot of the higher income countries because the differential in the tax is so small that the exemption will completely remove that. So if you, even if you were earning 4 million in the UK from the calculations that we've done, you shouldn't be making any top-ups to SARS because you pay tax in the UK and you get a foreign tax credit there, and that will completely eliminate the tax that you need to pay to SARS. So in effect, this is removing those high income tax countries through this exemption. The second comment was that the cost of living in foreign countries is higher than in SA and should be taken into account. And also, what about consumption taxes, indirect taxes, fees, user charges, etc.? We said noted there. We haven't said accepted. We said noted. We're a bit worried about the principle that this applies if we had said accepted. So we've said noted. We don't have a differential tax system within the country for cost of living differences. So you don't get a higher or a lower tax rate if you have a higher rental or a higher, you're living in a more costly area. So it's a difficult path to go down. Also, if you look at other countries, they don't include any of the consumption taxes, indirect taxes, etc. in their foreign tax credits. So we've noted it, but we do think that the exemption threshold, in effect, caters for this issue, this cost of living issue. The one proposal that we did discuss in the workshop with which the PBO were present was to have a country-by-country cost of living table, similar to the travel subsistence allowance table that SARS has. We felt that this was too complicated. It was you'd have to change it every year. Every single country would have a different value, and we didn't want to go down that route. We thought it would be much simpler, much easier for everybody to understand, especially if education is an issue, especially on this topic, to have one single exemption. So our proposal is the one single exemption. The next major change, adjustment that we've made is that what about people who have these contracts that they've entered into and they've gone overseas for the next 5 years for a three-year contract, five-year contract? They expected the tax system to be a certain way for that period. What about them? We thought about a phasing-in approach. But again, it was quite complicated, and we didn't think that a lot of taxpayers would understand it. So we've partially accepted that. We've proposed that we extend the effective date to 1 March 2020, which is 1 year out, so that in effect you'll have 2.5 years from now to rearrange any contracts that you have, rearrange any circumstances that you may need, formalize your tax affairs with SARS, whatever you need to do. So we've given that additional year compared to the initial proposal. The next one, that there are only two out of 196 countries that have implemented such a proposal. It's unduly harsh, and we're not comparable to other countries. And that we've said not accepted. That's an misunderstanding of the proposal. That proposal is based on citizenship. This is based on tax residency, which is completely separate. So you don't need to give up your citizenship. You could, for example, give up your South African passport, but SARS would still see you as a South African tax resident, and you would still be taxed. So that's the one big misunderstanding that has been that has permeated through this proposal. But it's not based on citizenship; it's only on tax residency. The next comment was that the foreign tax credit can only be claimed on assessment. So this means that pays-you-in taxpayers and provisional taxpayers have to pay taxes in two jurisdictions. So we had, I had a lot of sympathy with this initially. So what if you were paying, withholding pays-you-in in a foreign country, but then SARS are also asking you to withhold pays-you-in here. So in effect, you double your tax twice, and then you can only get the cash at the end. In discussions with SARS, there is a directive system that already allows employers not to withhold the additional tax in South Africa. So if they go to SARS and say, look, we are withholding this tax in the foreign jurisdiction, then you don't need to withhold the tax in the local jurisdiction. So this doesn't look as if we need a legislative change, that there are mechanisms already to avoid this, in effect, that double tax with only being able to claim at a later stage. And similarly, for provisional taxpayers, the comments were that, well, provisional taxpayers can't take the foreign tax credit into account, so they'll also be worse off in year from a cash flow perspective. But according to the law, they can actually take that foreign tax credit into account from our discussions with SARS. So again, there's no need for us to make any changes. They can, if you are paying tax in another country and you're a provisional taxpayer, you can take that tax off and pay a smaller amount of tax in terms of being a provisional taxpayer. So there shouldn't be those unintended effects there. Another comment was that there's just very long delays to process and allow for foreign tax credits, and this proposal would overwhelm the current system. Given that we now have a 1 million exemption, there should be far fewer number of submissions for foreign tax credits through to SARS, so we do not believe that it would overwhelm the system. Also, in discussions with SARS, the system is currently there with foreign tax credits. It's working. This isn't a new system. There is a process already in place. And, you know, they do not believe, and, you know, we believe them, that they do not believe that we need to make any adjustments in this realm, that it does actually work. The next one is on requests to amend Section 6 Quat. So this is the foreign tax credit that you can take into account. So the comments were saying, can we include social security and pension contributions in the value of the foreign tax credit that we can deduct? So this was quite a difficult one. From a conceptual perspective, if it's a social security contribution, it does imply that you will then be getting a benefit at the end. So if you contribute to a social security system, you might be getting a basic state pension at the end. If you were in South Africa and you were receiving a basic state pension from another country, that would be exempt. We wouldn't tax you on that amount at all. So that amount could come in from any other country, be paid to you, and we wouldn't tax you. So in effect, it almost seems as if, well, if we allow the deduction on the credits on the one side, you're not getting taxed, but also if you're getting the income here, you're not getting taxed. So then we looked at other country examples, and in other countries, it doesn't look as if social security contributions are included. It's only income taxes that or other countries who include, who calculate foreign tax credits. So it doesn't look as if social security contributions are included. So we've gone with the proposal of not accepted. If we look at the implications for higher tax countries, because of the value of the exemption, even without including social security contributions, they still wouldn't have to make top-up payments to SARS. People said, well, what about deductions to retirement funds? You know, can't we get an 11K deduction for that? If you're paying taxable income in South Africa, our proposal is you're very more than welcome to contribute to retirement annuity in South Africa, and you will get a deduction on that amount, and it will reduce your taxable income. So there's nothing stopping you if you're working overseas and you have taxable income that you now have to pay in South Africa due to this proposal. You can contribute to retirement annuity fund here, and you can get a deduction for that amount. The one comment in the main theme is it is unfair to impose taxes on people who are not present in South Africa to enjoy the benefits of public expenditure. So here we've said not accepted because we believe you should pay tax based on your tax residency, which has been an agreed upon principle in the global tax environment. So if you're a tax resident, and by the definition of being tax resident, either it's a physical presence test, so you're in the country for more than 915 days out of the last 5 years and more than 91 days out of each of those 5 years, you are by definition a tax resident. So if you're in that country, obviously there will be benefits to you being here. Also, in terms of the ordinarily resident test, it does look at your family, your other linkages to the country. So if there are these linkages with your family, with business, which, with whatever it is, surely there would be benefits that you are getting there. So if you do not have those linkages and you are outside of the country, i.e. you do not meet the physical presence test, then you're no longer defined as a tax resident, and then you wouldn't need to pay. So it's a difficult argument to make, and because there's so many different variations to it, but in our view, if you're seen as a tax resident, you should contribute to the economy and you should be paying taxes. And in that tax residence, underlying that, there is this fundamental notion of you being a tax resident because you are here, because you are getting benefits through the country. So that's what we believe, and it's certainly not out of line with the rest of the world. And globally, if you're a tax resident, you should be paying tax on your worldwide income. Another thing we didn't put there is if you're, you know, we're only talking here about an employment remuneration exemption. So the argument does also apply, well, what about your interest income you're earning, dividend income, independent contractor income, etc.? Why is it okay on the one hand but not on the other? I mean, I think that's all the main issues from the foreign income exemption. There are a couple of other issues that were brought up that we put into the response document, but are probably more technical and are not here.
Thank you, Chair. The next issue is the tax relief for bargaining council regarding tax non-compliance. As you have said, in the 2017 draft TLAB, we propose a relief, specific relief for bargaining council for non-compliance with tax legislation. And this relief is saying that bargaining council will be required to pay 10% of the total PAYE that should have been withheld from all payments made to their members, and 10% of the total untaxed investment income, and this covers a period of 5 years. So the comments that we received regarding bargaining council, I think Gloria commented that we said we are doing this relief because bargaining council will go under, and we have not given reasons why will they go under. What happens is that if SARS have found you to be tax non-compliant, when SARS raises an assessment, SARS will raise interest and penalties. And I think Franz from SARS is here. The amount of interest vary up to 200%, or penalties vary up to 200% for non-compliance. So you may find that your tax debt is less, and now the interest and penalties are more than the tax debt. So we had a meeting with the Department of Labor, because we are referring to bargaining council that are registered in terms of Section 28 of the Labor Relations Act that are administered by the Department of Labor. And we had consultations with the Department of Labor regarding... Yes. We had consultations with the Department of Labor regarding the fact that bargaining council may go under if the penalties and interest are imposed by SARS for non-compliance. And hence we came up with this proposal for relief. This is a proposal. As Momo has said, Parliament will say yes or Parliament will say no. Okay, the first comment that came about with this proposal was that the relief is unfair and is generous, overly generous, and it is targeted only to the certain taxpayers, which is bargaining council. And it may arguably be unconstitutional on the basis that it places bargaining council in a favored position vis-a-vis other taxpayers. We are saying that this is not accepted. The proposed relief, although it is targeted to bargaining council, it is not discriminatory in nature and passes the test of general application because it applies to about 40 bargaining council, 1.8 million members of the bargaining council, as well as to the employers. So if it's applying to 1.8 million taxpayers who are members of the bargaining council, we think that it passes the test of general application. Also, we are of the view that it will be grossly prejudicial to treat the proposed relief differently from other amnesties that the Minister of Finance has given in the past. For instance, we had the exchange control amnesty in 2003 and the small business tax amnesty in 2006, which was the small business amnesty was targeted to certain taxpayers. So we are saying that this relief is fair for the bargaining council. And also, The next comment. There was a view that why are we giving this special relief? Why can't we use the current provisions in the Tax Administration Act? I think Carl from PwC was very strong on that, that there are current provisions in the Tax Administration Act, like your voluntary disclosure program and other provisions for tax debts that could be used for non-compliant bargaining counsel. We're saying that this is not accepted because currently there are different tax treatments for different bargaining councils. That's what we found out. And then if now we have to go to the voluntary disclosure program, meaning that about 1.8 million members of the bargaining council have to apply if those employers did not apply. So we feel that this relief, it is fair because it will be difficult to administer all those people. And then thirdly, during the workshops, as Gloria said, there were a number of uncertainties regarding the correct tax treatment of the contributions, benefits paid, and investment income of the bargaining council. The people who were there, who were representing the bargaining council, were saying that they've treated some of the contributions. For instance, if an employer is contributing to a sick pay, is treated differently. You find that, or holiday pay, the employer has to withhold the contribution and the tax from the contribution. And in other scenarios, if it maybe it's maternity, you find that it's the employee that the tax has to be withheld on the lump sum. So there are different tax treatments regarding contributions and payments from the bargaining council. We partially accept this because that has emerged during the public consultation. What we have done, we are engaging with the bargaining council, and they are giving us the information that we want and the way they are applying this different tax treatment. And then we, by having that information, we'll address these inconsistencies. The next one on the proposal, of which also Gloria referred to, is addressing the circumvention of anti-avoidance rules dealing with share buybacks and dividend stripping. These are anti-avoidance measures that we introduced in the Income Tax Act. Based, it has come to government attention that taxpayers are circumventing these rules by doing schemes, anti-avoidance schemes, regarding share buybacks and dividend stripping. So we are introducing these measures. However, the effective date that we proposed, it was the date of the publication of the bill, which is 19 July 2017. From the workshops, we were told that as Gloria said, that effective date is retrospectively, overly retrospective, because it will taint the dividends that were already distributed. Even though those dividends were not distributed based on the anti-avoidance schemes, I'm gonna deal with that. The first comment that we received was that this anti-avoidance measure is too broad because it applies to dividends. It will retain dividends received in the preceding 18 months, irrespective of whether they are related to or linked to the share sale. We partially accept this proposal that it may be too broad, but the period of 18 months will remain. However, this anti-avoidance rule will apply to what is known as extraordinary dividends, so as to limit it to those dividends that we think are tainted. The next one. Another view was that this anti-avoidance measure is too wide and it will negatively affect vanilla preference shares typically used by companies to raise funding. We accept this. So the 2017 draft TLAB will be changed to contain an exclusion in respect of preference shares, provided that they meet that certain criteria. So we accept that we don't want to impact vanilla transactions. The last one, okay, the next one here is that the issue of the effective date that Gloria raised. We partially accept this, and now the proposal will apply only to those arrangements that were not finalized on 19 July, as well as any future arrangements that will be subject, those future arrangements will be subject to new provisions. So if you've entered into a scheme and everything has been finalized by 19 July and maybe if your dividends have been paid by 19 July, then this provision will not apply to you. So we agree with that comment. The next one, that's where we said everyone has got different views. Then the next comment was that the proposed shareholding of 50% and 20% may be subject to a loophole, because in the case of listed companies, the shareholding that they look at is lower than 20%. So we may have a shareholding of 50% and 20%, but the listed companies can still be able to circumvent these provisions. So we accept that. So now we're going to have two different tests: the test, the shareholding test for listed companies, and the shareholding test for non-listed companies. And for listed companies, the test will be 10%, and for non-listed companies, it will be 50 and 20% as applied. But the 20% rule will be minimized to apply to those proposed amendments that are in there. Okay, the next one was that this amendment is too broad. It will affect BEE transactions. We have noted this issue, and then we are saying that it is clear that if a BEE partner wants to disinvest from a transaction, you are disinvesting. So it's either you sell your shares. So if you sell your shares through the normal sale, the CGT that's going to be imposed. But if you disinvest through share buybacks, meaning that there's not going to be CGT because you'll be doing the share buyback. So this anti-avoidance rule is putting share buybacks in the same position as when you sell the shares and you are taxed on CGT. That's what this amendment is doing. So we're saying that is noted. If you want to disinvest, whether you are a BEE or non-BEE, the rules should apply equally to everyone. The next rule is that the 2017 draft TLAB, we proposed certain amendments to tax implications of debt relief because companies were facing problems regarding finance and the debt, so we're trying to assist. But in trying to assist in the draft TLAB, there were things that we did not quite do correctly that were hurting companies even though we're trying to assist, or we did not even match the legislation. So the first one is debt relief for mining companies. In this scenario, they say that the current provisions apply to direct and indirect funding. And in making specific rules applicable to mining companies, we omitted to say that it applies to both direct and indirect funding. That is accepted and noted. It's gonna apply to direct and indirect funding. The next one was saying that if you are saying that mining companies should enjoy the current tax treatment as other companies, then the provisions in paragraph 12A of the SKQ and section 19, and the provisions contained in paragraph 12A of the SKQ should also apply to mining companies, that those exceptions. We accept that. We're going to extend the exceptions that are available in paragraph 12A of the SKQ to section 36.7EA that applies to mining companies. Another comment which is minor but is very important for mining companies, because section 15, which is the charging provision for mining companies, refers to mining operations, does not refer to mining companies. And then in our draft TLAB, we colloquially refer to mining companies. So we're told that there is a mismatch, and then it also leads to paragraph J of the definition of gross income. So we're going to change the proposed change, the legislation from mining companies to mining operation as envisaged in the Act. Okay, the next one was that what happens if someone is carrying different mining operations? Can you reduce the debt from one mining operation to another mining operation? And here we are saying that it will only be ring-fenced to that mining operation. It's not going to be transferred. The next one was that the definition of capital expenditure includes notional amounts, like in the case of certain gold mines, and certain amounts relating to low-cost residential units for employees. Now they want to know when a reduction amount arises, might these amounts be also reduced by this? We are saying noted. When we make changes to these provisions, the notional amounts will not be subject to the proposed provisions. The next one is debt relief for dormant companies, dormant group companies. The 2017 draft TLEB, we propose that the current relief for group companies available in paragraph 12A be restricted to dormant companies and intra-group debt converted to equity extended to section 19. So we have extended the current group relief available in paragraph 12A to section 19. However, we found that the current group relief that is available in paragraph 12A is too wide. So we are also restricting this to apply only to dormant companies and Section 41 group companies, that is the local South African group companies, instead of the multinational group companies. That's what you are doing. So the first question, the first comment was that the proposed amendment narrows the current group exception that is contained in paragraph 12A, and under the exception, a company is only considered to be dormant if during the year that the debt is waived and the three immediate preceding years of assessment, and it did not carry on any trade, receive or accrue any amount, transfer, did not receive any income. So we accept that the requirements are too stringent. So we're going to limit the test to say that the company must be carrying on a trade, firstly, must not be carrying on a trade. That is the test. And secondly, it will be only limited to 2 years, that is the years preceding and the current years of assessment, instead of 3 years, so that we can limit the stringent requirements, so we can relax the stringent requirements. The next one that we had here, we were trying to assist conversion of debt into equity. There were, the current tax rules did not address this. But what SARS found from the ruling was that taxpayers were applying for rulings, and you find that, and SARS found that, that there is no anti-avoidance at all. But it says that taxpayers have got problems. So rulings were given by SARS in the positive in this regard. So what we are doing now, we are taking, we want to make this in the law so that it's not applied via rulings. So we are making a law to this legislation. So so what happens is that we introduced two rules, that is Section 19 Cap A, which was applying to debt that was owed to people not subject to tax, that is debt that was paid to foreign companies, and Section 19 B, which was applying to group relief, like a clawback for if you degroup. So what happens is that they were saying that now by having the new rules of Section 19 A and Section 19 B, they don't know which rules apply first. Do the current rules of Section 19 apply, or do we apply the new rules of Section 19A and 19KFB? And we have created a lot of confusion by trying to assist them in this regard. We accept that comment. What we're going to do, we're going to repeal or remove the proposed Section 19KFA and 19KFB from this 2017 draft TLEB. And then what we're going to do, we're going to define the reduction amount in Section 19 so that it covers these scenarios where the conversion of debt into equity, so that the rule is in the law, so that people don't need to apply for a ruling, whereas the rule is in the legislation. Okay. The next one that we have is the exclusion of impairment adjustment in the determination of taxable income of Section 24 JB. Do you want to talk about it? Okay, what happens is that on 17 February 2012, SARS issued a directive for banks that they should apply in respect of impairment adjustment. This directive was only related to banks, and this directive was based on the fact that currently the taxpayers are using IS 39 instead of IFRS 9. So in the 2017 budget review, we said that in view of the fact that IFRS 9 will be introduced, there is a need to look at this directive because this directive was based on IS 39. So, and then we said that in view of the fact that the banks are highly regulated by the Banks Act and the Reserve Bank, they've got stringent capital liquidity requirements than any other financial services providers. So we're going to continue applying this rule only to banks based on that issue. And we had meetings with the reserve banks and the banks. And now what we are saying here is that we are proposing only for banks and not for other financial institutions in terms of impairment adjustment, that is 25% of IFRS 9 loss allowance relating to impairment based on annual financial statements. However, when it comes to 85%, we are basing it on the amount that is classified as being in default in terms of Regulation 67 issued by SARB in terms of the Banks Act. And then the comments that we received was that in terms of the 85% allowance, why are we basing it on Regulation 67 issued by the Reserve Bank? We should be basing this on IFRS 9. And then we said that, no, that is not accepted. We're not going to base it on IFRS 9 because we're having here special dispensation for banks because banks are highly regulated by South African Reserve Bank. And then if banks are highly regulated by South African Reserve Bank, then there's no problem in referring this to a Regulation 67, which is issued by the Reserve Bank. So, and then also the suggest, and then what happens is that IFRS 9 requires each entity to define the term, and this would not result in alignment between banks, because they were saying that we're going to have problems in having to align, in having to comply with the Regulation 67 and also IFRS 9, and we said that this is not accepted. And then another issue that was said was that the regulation for stage 3 category of impairment, the proposed 85 allowance of an amount classified as being in default in terms of Regulation 67 only applies to credit exposure and not retail exposure. That was the issue that was raised during the public comment stage. Except that changes will be made in the 2017 draft lab in order for the proposed 85% allowance to include the retail exposure. The next one was that the current proposal only applies to banks and does not apply to other financial institutions, and then the issues of equity were raised. And then we are saying that is noted, and then we say that the reason why the proposal is applying to banks is because banks are subject, are registered, banks that are registered in terms of the Banks Act are subject to stringent financial liquidity requirements by the Reserve Bank. Hence, this proposal is applicable only to banks. However, we will study the impact if now we extend this proposal to other financial institutions. We'll study the impact that will have on the fiscus, and then after that we will see if we can extend this to other financial institutions. And then another proposal that they were having was that now that we are changing the impairment adjustment from 100% that used to apply in terms of the directive from SARS to 85%. And then now they are saying that they are requesting a phase-in in this regard so that it will assist in the negative impact. And then we are saying that, yes, we note that in the past we have allowed phase-in provisions to be introduced when the proposed changes will have significant cash flow to the industry. In this scenario, we have received information from 4 banks. There is not too much significant cash flow. However, we have not received information from other banks regarding the numbers. But if maybe we receive that information and we see that there's going to be a significant cash flow, hence we are saying noted, we're going to see if the phase-in provisions are required and how long. But at this point in time, the information that we receive does not show a significant negative cash flow impact. The next one is that the 2017 draft TLAB proposed that the CFC rules be extended so that foreign companies held through a foreign trust or a foreign foundation and whose financial results from part of the consolidated financial statements in terms of IFRS 10 be treated as CFC. This was an anti-avoidance measure. So during the comment stage, in the proposed draft TLAB, we had a provision in Section 9D, and we introduced a new Section 25 CAPBC in this regard. And then the 25 KPC applies to natural persons, and Section 9D applies to persons other than natural persons. So during the comment period and during the workshops, we were told that the proposed amendments are too broad. And you remember the presentation by Weber Wenzel that will affect even wealth trust and other trusts that are not created for this. So in this scenario, we are having a meeting already. We have set a meeting on the 19th of September with the industry to deal specifically with these issues. Because we are saying that, yes, we still want to have these provisions, but we will see the amendments that are going to be made so that the provisions are targeted to address only anti-avoidance measures. We've already set a meeting with the industry for the 19th of September. There are already suggestions, as Gloria has said, that there are different views during workshops. Others are saying, yes, maybe you can keep the provisions but limit it in this manner. Others are saying remove these provisions. So on the 19th of September next week, we are having a meeting with the industry. We're going to come with the proposed solution from that meeting. As Moma has said, this is a draft response document. Once we've solved the issue, then it will make a final response document once the bill is introduced in Parliament. Thank you.
So, Chair, I get to sing for my supper now, or at least my water, and just move over to the Draft Tax Administration Laws Amendment Bill. Fortunately, we have a smaller package to go through, so let's start off with the taxation of the reimbursed travel allowance. Essentially, here, the concern was, well, how is this going to work? And so we will obviously, as we say, they extend the memorandum of objects just to clarify. I think people are reading more into this change than is actually there. They're worrying about certain limitations that only apply in assessment, and will they apply here in the pay-as-you-earn system? The answer is no. But we thought we'd gotten there. They don't think we have, so we'll beef up the memorandum of objects to get them over the hump. The 350,000 Rand cap for retirement fund contributions, you'll recall I explained we for simplicity, we wanted to spread that over 12 months and turn that into, as it stands at the moment, 29,167 Rand monthly cap. There's some concerns there because people are saying, well, hang on a second, what happens if I in one month contribute more but in other months less? I'll lose a portion of the cap. And so the answer there is no, you're not losing it. You just get to claim it on assessment. This is just to simplify the employees' tax implication. One of the people who attended the workshop came up with an innovative variation. They came up with what I'm calling there a rolling cumulative approach, which would allow you to add up over the course of the year what you haven't used and then use that at a later stage. The problem there is I actually tried to do that in a spreadsheet, and it gets quite complicated. So for payrolls, it's going to be a rather messy system. But your other problem is, well, then it depends when you get paid, because if you got your sort of large lump sum at the beginning of the year, you've got nothing to offset, but if you did it later in the year, then you'd have the previous amounts to offset. So again, there's a number of issues there which I think are difficult for payroll systems to cater with. So the suggestion is we do not accept it. We retain the simple 29,167 Rand monthly cap, and if there is any unutilized amount, that will be balanced out on assessment, and you'll get your credit at that point. Fortunately, this all runs with third-party information, so it's relatively easy for SARS to check, which is not always the case. If we have a look then on the proposal that we put forward to bring dividends on certain share incentive schemes into the pay-as-you-earn net and have the person who paid the dividends be included as someone who had to deduct pay-as-you-earn. This got a lot of pushback from what are known as the CSDPs, the people who hold shares in the listed company environment on behalf of the companies that administer the share registers. And they were saying, well, you know, it's impossible for us because now we have to create a whole payroll system for people who hold shares, and we don't know who to apply it to. So we certainly take that point. So the proposal here is to drop the suggestion that the CSDPs or people who pay out the dividend need to withhold the tax. It is, however, the employer or the share incentive trust that has to withhold the tax. And they would then notify the CSDP that dividends withholding tax should. So you then match the systems that way. And the legislative mechanism for doing all of that already exists. So it should be something the CSDP should be able to handle. Then we had the amendment to Section 9. The chair may recall last year there was a late submission on the mineral and petroleum resources royalty changes, which said, hang on a second, if it's not subject to objection and appeal when there's a change in the estimated payment during the course of the year, how do we handle this? And part of our response there was, well, hang on, you've pointed out a technical problem here. Because in terms of that act, you have a self-assessment of that estimated tax. So now you have an assessment that is not subject to objection and appeal, which our legislative framework doesn't deal with very comfortably. This proposal brings it into the fold, matches it up. But the question we got was, well, how do we access this? We don't see it in dispute resolution. And the response is, well, no, you're not going to see it in dispute resolution because it isn't a dispute resolution issue. It's more a complaint management issue. And that's where you'll, in fact, find the process to handle this. Because what SARS is doing is essentially going back and re-looking at a discretion or a decision. And then finally, refunds. But in this case, fraudulent refunds. So the banks have fairly sophisticated risk systems that allow them to pick up VAT frauds and other frauds where SARS is being targeted to get a fraudulent refund. And the way it works currently is the bank spots something in its risk system, notifies SARS, SARS looks at it, says, yes, hold that amount, and then the bank essentially places a hold on that account. The problem here is, of course, that these people are relatively sophisticated, and so the money moves very quickly. And so even if SARS acts in a matter of hours, that money may well be gone, because that's their whole business. It's to get money from SARS and transfer it into other accounts and make sure it disappears out of the system as fast as they can possibly get it out. So the financial institutions approached us and said, look, this could work better if we place the hold and notify you. And again, this then raised a question from commenters saying, hang on a sec, this is too broad. You should in fact go and ask the taxpayer whether it's realistic to place a hold, or SARS should retain that decision-making power. Now, again, you have a problem here. So the suggestion then is you are approaching someone who is potentially a fraudster to ask them why you should stop them doing transactions with their account. What do you think their reaction is going to be? Well, to do the transaction immediately and then say, well, whatever they're going to say. So, on the other hand, though, you certainly understand the issue here, because you don't want holds being placed on people's accounts willy-nilly. Now, the point here is the bank must have a reasonable suspicion here. So it can't be something that is fanciful. It's limited to a refund payment by SARS. Okay, and the bank has got to have a reasonable suspicion that that refund is being obtained illegally. Okay, so it is a very narrow provision, and then it only applies for 2 business days. So after 2 business days, it automatically lifts. It also may lift if SARS or High Court instructs otherwise. So if you're in that very narrow situation and it's incorrect, then you can always approach SARS, or if you absolutely had to, the High Court, to have the hold lifted. But again, I just come back to the point, it's pretty narrow, and we think that as it currently stands, it makes sense. Of course, there is one last thing. You may ask the question, well, wouldn't a bank reasonably suspect a lot of transactions? And as an article that was published yesterday by someone in one of the larger law firms pointed out, if banks were unwise in applying this provision, they would open themselves up to damage claims from their clients, and also reputational loss. So I can sort of state with a reasonable degree of comfort that banks are not going to be in the business of unreasonably applying this provision, because there's nothing in it for them to do so, and there is, in fact, a great deal of reputational and potential monetary cost for them if they were to do so. So those are the SARS issues.
Can I suggest that it might be more productive to hear what the civil society industry has to say, and then we respond to both sets of issues? Is that okay? Because we had Gloria, we have you, and so on. But there is a practical matter. I see Mr. Mania has left. He's not coming back. All right. Look, it's not a big deal. Frank, where's Frank? Can you just check where Frank is? Frank, you're here. Ah, yes. Can I draw your attention? You've distributed this report. Can I just draw your attention to some things that happened after yesterday's meeting? They're in red, right? On the MAFR report. If you look at page 2, 1.823, that should read in red from the beginning. Zakela pointed out that we just didn't have hearings. We also had a separate sitting on transformation of the auditing profession. I met Saika and the rest of them there. So he reminded me we'd done that. Actually, he sent it to me while I was sitting here in the committee. And he's finalizing the financial sector transformation report. And he's right, so I just put that in. That's a straightforward matter, right? Then the next issue is, then the two questions, that question marks we had, the simple ones, they were letters. I just got the dates of the letters, so that's not a policy issue. Derek drew our attention to that. Then if you go to 523, on page 23, given that we now put in the section that I said we forgot about, 523 simply says, we support the transformation of the auditing profession programs discussed at the 22 June briefing, which we forgot about yesterday, but believe far more needs to be done sooner. So basically that's it. The other changes we agreed yesterday. One is a typographical one on the next page. 521 should read 51 to 523 now, and 56 and 5. Floyd suggested we start with saying we support the MFA rules. That's put down. So basically, the only change since yesterday that is any significance at all is 1.823 and 523. Now, Frank, according to you, we don't really have to vote on this thing, and we just note it, right? Or do we have to vote on it?
I'm not sure. I mean, for me, it's minor amendments, and half of them is what we discussed yesterday.
Anyway,
so unless someone is uncomfortable with it.
All right, so can we get a consensus here? Are we agreeable? We don't have to vote on this again. They minor. We just forgot. Zakele had sent it to me. I didn't see it until late last night. So this is the report we're going to send off. I will write a letter that goes with this, right? Oh, I wanted to just say something else that Tebogo pointed out to me. Where's Tebogo? Let her calm down. She was very cheesed off about this thing. I just put in there something about... oh, yes. There was something else. You remember, colleagues, we initially said we will do a provisional report and then we will give it to the stakeholders to comment on, right? Like we're doing with the financial sector transformation report. But we did that before the minister and the IRBA went ahead and said, hey, right. So it lost its meaning. So to explain that, and I'll write a letter, if you look at 5.2, there's no point giving them the report as a provisional. It's not going to make any effect, material effect. So we put 5.2, the committee initially intended to decide on a provisional or interim report, which we refer to all stakeholders to comment on within a deadline before adopting the final report. But because the IRBA went ahead to implement the MAFR rules, and the minister endorsed this, as already covered in this report, including in sections 1.4 to 1.7, this becomes unnecessary. It covers the points you made. So the stakeholders are aware. And I will write to them to say, what is the point of your report? We can't do much about this thing now. Right, but I have explained to your leader of the party and I've explained to our study group previously or to individuals. I am what's his name, Mr. Mania, because I have to get his agreement. Okay, I mean your section of the committee, that I will continue to engage with all parties via the Ministry of the Office as well and directly to continue to talk about these things, right? Yeah. Yes, you want to say something? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I had to step out, so I missed the major discussion on this aspect. On the comment, I know you're talking about the IRBA report. What I want to say there is that although in the report you do state that you don't necessarily have powers to tell the RBA what to do, but the thing is there's been such progression with the implementation of the rule, and there is now really trying, there's been momentum in the buy-in from the profession, and the views that I expressed in the report by the committee are, in my view, will then add salt to the injury that it will cause friction between the profession and the MFIR. So I do strongly think that we need to reconsider the views that I expressed in the report. And
but it's completely out of order with due respect to you. This is a politician's decision. It has nothing to do with the PBO. We welcome you to contact issues, but you can't ask us to review this. After we've considered discussion, spent hours preparing the report, and there's a lot of politics involved here, which with due respect, I can talk to you on the phone, but it'll be very inappropriate for you to change the decision of politics. But we can talk outside. I'll give you a ring, or you can give me a ring. Okay, thank you very much. Can we then move on to say that we now invite the stakeholders to comment? Who wants to comment? Now, we don't want a rehash of the hearing. No, that's to do the MFR report. Is that right? No, it's out of order, really. That's to do with the audit rotation report, which has been voted on already. It's an out of order question. This is completely different. It has nothing to do with the PBO, but you're welcome to comment. Except that, you see, this has nothing to do with tax. This is a report we voted on yesterday.
I'm aware, Chair, that we're now talking about the mandatory audit.
Yeah, we voted on it.
Yes. But I'm just saying that in the report, you are...
Well, you know, we discussed all of that.
Okay, I think let's rather have this discussion offline.
She wasn't around. Tanya wasn't at the... No, I don't think we can have that discussion. With due respect, there are limits, really. This report has been discussed endlessly. It was taken to a study group, which Tanya wasn't at.
I don't know.
Yeah, fine. So there's nothing... It's totally correct for a chair to say, Tanya, out of order, with due respect, Gloria. We really respect your views on tax, but on this one, it's like political interference, and it's really out of order. Can we go on? And in this committee, let me tell you, I don't know of any other committee in Parliament where the secretary is allowed to speak, the researcher is allowed to speak, and the content advisors to speak. Tandy knows that she never allowed it in the committee she chaired, or in any committee in Parliament. So we will do what we always do, whether it's COSATU or PwC, doesn't matter. This is Parliament, the procedure adopted in July 2014, and it's never been changed, and Tanvi strongly supported it, is whenever we have public hearings, we get a response from the government department concerned, then we hear from the stakeholders, whoever they are, NGOs or big monopoly capital, their Parliament, and then you reply, and then we engage with you. That's the way we do it, and we're not going to change that, at least. Yeah, can we go on? Right, now here it is. We are not going to rehash the workshop you had. We're not going to rehash that. But having heard Treasury respond now, do you want to say anything further so that the committee, when it processes the bill and decides on policy issues, is better able to process them and take all factors into account? There's no need repeating what you said there, because they've covered what you said. Add to us as MPs understanding these issues, because you have technical skills we don't have. So, over to who wants to speak first? Yeah, yes.
Thank you. It's Carl Mandy from PwC, the tax policy leader. Maybe just a few comments I want to make. One is actually on the consultation process itself. And I think as what be very clear from what's been feedback here, the consultation process does work and is effective, and Treasury does listen. We certainly don't suggest that there should be agreement on everything, and clearly there won't be. So it does work in that regard. The one thing that I would like to say, though, is that I think it can be done more efficiently. It doesn't help that we come to Parliament. We haven't even had any consultations on most of the issues at this point in time, and the bill the final bill changes fundamentally, if you like, from what was initially presented as the draft bill. So I think it can be done more efficiently. I certainly like to see engagement taking place before a draft bill is even finalised, more than it does place. And this is not new to the likes of Younger. I've had this discussion with her before. But that is something I would like to see, to try and make the process a little bit more efficient and address some of the issues that come with it. All right, on to some of the specifics. Just on the repeal of the foreign employment income exemption, we certainly welcome Treasury's amended proposals. In fact, I think they've been quite generous. They've been more generous than certainly what our recommendations were, because over and above the threshold, which we recommended as well, we actually recommended that the number of days required for the exemption be increased from the 183 days to, and we suggested possibly 325 days, but you could pick a number in between if you like. The reason why we did that, because in my discussions with Treasury, it became clear that they were concerned with some of the abuse that was taking place around manipulation of the number of days. So where taxpayers were purposefully, if you like, staying outside the country for a longer period in order to make the 183-day threshold. If you increase that to a more significant number, let's say we suggested 325, but it was just a suggestion. You could have, as I say, pick a higher number of days. But if you increased it significantly above the 183 days, it would make it far more difficult for taxpayers to manipulate. So that was just the one comment I'd like to make in that respect. On the bargaining councils, and Younger, forgive me for this, something I feel fairly strongly about, so I'm going to continue to say what I've been saying to Treasury as well. It's acknowledged that the bargaining councils and the members of the bargaining councils, more pertinently, in some respects, would face significant financial hardship were they to be held liable for employment taxes that should have been paid and haven't been paid, along with interest and penalties in that regard. I think this is going to maybe provide some technical clarity in terms of how the law actually works insofar as the employees' tax aspect is concerned. The primary port of call for SARS is actually to go after the employer. So in this instance, we're talking about the bargaining councils themselves and not to go after the members directly. If SARS goes after the employer, the bargaining councils, collects taxes there, the bargaining council would then have a right to recover that tax from the individual employees, being the members of the bargaining council. That is their prerogative whether they do so or don't. Okay, there's no obligation on them to do so. So at the moment, what's being proposed here is that relief be given to both the members and to the bargaining councils in its entirety, subject to the bargaining councils paying this 10% levy that's being proposed. Yeah. What has also become clear, though, during the consultation process is that there is a complete lack of clarity or uncertainty on what the correct tax treatment is in relation to the different product offerings or benefits offered by the bargaining councils to their members. Some are suggesting that actually in some instances the real employer, who must actually withhold tax on the contributions that have been paid, and I understand in certain instances that has been done. Whereas in other situations it's suggested that, well, maybe it's actually the bargaining council themselves who have the obligation to withhold the employees' tax and pay it over, which I understand in many instances actually has not been done. But there's actually uncertainty insofar as that aspect is concerned, and I would suggest that it actually depends on the facts and circumstances of each particular case, taking into account each particular benefit offered by the bargaining council. So given that scenario, I don't think it's appropriate to utilize the proposed mechanism to provide relief to the bargaining councils. Yeah. I do think it's appropriate to provide relief to the individual members and that they should be exempted insofar as past history is concerned. But insofar as the bargaining councils themselves are concerned, what I would suggest is the appropriate mechanism is to resolve any uncertainty through the appropriate
processes that SARS would follow in terms of auditing and assessing taxes and applying the dispute resolution processes as appropriate to determine what, if any, is the actual tax liability along with interest and penalties that the bargaining council should be facing. And then, once that process has been completed, once then consider what the financial implications for the bargaining councils may or may not be as a result of any such tax liabilities. In those circumstances, the Tax Administration Act already contains provisions, and Fas will be very happy to hear me saying this again. The TAA contains the appropriate provisions to provide relief from debt in appropriate circumstances, along with the appropriate governance processes to be followed by SARS in that regard. So that is my suggestion, that that is something that maybe the committee should consider and apply its mind to, as I would suggest being the appropriate mechanism that should be followed in this case.
Do you need, because in fairness...
No, I understand. No, yeah, I think those are the key points I wanted
to
make.
Issues, and then in, you know, another 5 minutes, and then... is there anybody else from the industry wants to speak? Okay, in fairness, I'm not going to give more than 10 minutes each. It's not fair. Does any member have a problem with that? No. 10 minutes is enough. Because remember, we think Treasury, frankly, listening to them carefully, but we listen to you, has gone some way, and listening to Gloria also, you know. And then I spoke to Zakhele. Antonio, you might want to say something as well about the workshop, if you want to, in a moment. Right. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Yeah, to be honest, I don't think there's anything else significant. I mean, it's just purely to acknowledge, again, that Treasury has listened to us. We certainly accept the points that they've made around all of the acceptance of the issues that we've raised around things like the dividend stripping provisions, the debt relief and so on. Obviously, the devil will be in the detail when we get to the legislation, but we will engage further as necessary in that regard.
Okay, next person, please. You want to speak here.
Thanks. It's Christelle from VAC, Project Director at SAICA. We just have a few comments. So just firstly, again, on the consultation process, we note that to some extent we have been consulted whether it's a truly efficient process is, again, something we would want to continue engaging in with SCOF and Treasury. We would like to understand, for example, you know, how do some of these workshops that we have, like after the fact, a workshop is proposed on CFC rules on the 19th, so how does that, for example, fit into, you know, this sort of process? You know, we still, we made the point all along that we need more consultation with Treasury beforehand. So I think that point just remains on the table. Then with regards to the 1010 relief, the foreign tax exemption, just one or two points. Chris, you mentioned something about high tax credit in the UK being given. We're not sure exactly how that would work because we were under the impression that credit would be claimed here if you're tax resident. So we don't necessarily agree with that response. Then again, also, just to add on to what Carla said on the bargaining councils, we don't agree that it's not discriminatory, and the mere fact that it involves 1.8 million individuals doesn't necessarily mean that it's not discriminatory compared to other industries. We also need to know what happens in future, what if similar behaviours occur in different industries, perhaps different groups. Maybe if you just take a normal situation where 1.8 normal taxpayers stops meeting their tax obligations, I think this really drives the wrong example, because you're literally saying, well, if you're not compliant, then we'll give you this relief, and that's not, I think, the idea. Taxpayers should be treated fairly. I do agree that the existing mechanisms available in the Tax Administration Act should already address, and I therefore agree with what Carla said on that point. There's a lot available, and it normally wouldn't be involving a direct negotiation with SARS on, you know, on the when it comes to the audit, you involve the bargaining councils on behalf of their members. So they'll normally be representing their members in that, and so that should necessarily be an issue to have too many people involved in the dispute process. The audit process should probably just be handled properly, as you would do with any other normal taxpayer. Then just the point on extraordinary dividends, we just wanted to say we welcome the fact that Treasury is actually looking at making these changes we requested. We just want to make sure that there are still not, even in the case of extraordinary dividends, that it doesn't, you know, there could still be situations where you could have extraordinary dividends that are not part of the anti-avoidance scheme. So can we just make sure that that's also addressed? It doesn't go too broadly still. And then we just have one question, clarity on whether the group relief that's not for dormant companies will be extended to...
Well, it's extended to Section 19.
And, sorry, just one last point on the foreign exemption. We just want to know, for example, if you have a property in South Africa, whether, you know, if you're renting out a property in South Africa, with that foreign employment income exemption, with that specifically, it wouldn't cover your local, it must be very specific to the foreign income earned. We just, I think it's going to be a question of definition. Thank you.
Who do you represent?
I'm Erika de Villiers. I'm the head of tax policy at SITE.
Okay.
I will try to be brief. I support most of what has been said already, especially the more general comments about consultation. On the foreign remuneration exemption, I am very concerned about the fact that the employee's tax that is withheld on a monthly basis in the foreign jurisdiction, that there won't be an explicit codified mechanism in the Act to automatically offset that against the employee's tax liability in South Africa. I know that there is the hardship directive route. I think that route can often be quite cumbersome, and I don't really see why it should not be legislated for to actually offset it automatically. I also think that it is useful it's a wonderful proposal. I think this is a very practical proposal, but I do still think that the SARS foreign tax clearing system is not working, and people wait for 2 years even if they do everything correctly. So I don't think that problem is going to go away to the extent that we rely on. On the bargaining councils, for me, I think it's important that the relief achieve what it's intended, and I think Carl's proposal was a good one. Support the share buybacks, that a targeted approach is followed. On the business rescue, I think this is a very positive development to my mind. I think the previous proposal went too far, and I'm hoping that in relooking at the proposal for next year, you know, we can work together to find a solution that really works well. Welcome the CFC meeting, can't say much more about that, except it's also good that it's targeted. And then I'd like to just maybe say that on the tax administration side and the administrative justice, There was a slot at the Treasury workshop to discuss tax administration. There was an opportunity to raise proposals that we had made for NHSC purposes that was never included in the budget. That's constructive. There hasn't been comment today so far on any of those substantive matters, and I'm really hoping that process will continue. Because some of the issues that we've raised are really very fundamental.
Okay. Move on then. Can members pose your questions, please? Mr. Lees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and as always, thanks to National Treasury and interested parties. Mr. Chairman, I think Chris is quite right. There's a great deal of misunderstanding out there, not least of which is the narrative given by some people, which seems to be designed to create that misunderstanding rather than to help. For instance, I got a huge amount of mail after the last briefing in M46 saying, you know, castigating me and the DA for accepting the changes in foreign employment tax. And so I'm suspicious. I know who in that meeting might have cast that assertion. And so it's not just a question of misunderstanding. There's deliberate misrepresentation, I believe, out there. So I think it's incumbent, as much as is possible, from National Treasury to get this record straight. But having said that, I mean, we expressed our concerns at the workshop, and the moves that have been made, I think, are pretty substantial, and I hope that the diaspora will look positively at those moves. Mr. Chairman, I do think, though, that the extension to 2020 should be a little bit longer, and we'll talk about that in our own meeting. The interesting comment about, now I can't remember, it must have been you, Chris, the foreign pensions paid out in South Africa are not taxed. Well, next year you'll come along and you'll introduce a tax on them, and then what? So, you know, this don't matter, France. So just, you know, we have to bear that in mind when we're going through. I'm sorry, I didn't make notes on my sheet. But while I'm paging, Mr. Chairman, the question of the foreign PAYE and the tax credit system, we had the tax ombud before us yesterday, and he wasn't just talking about VAT, which clearly is the major one, but there's clearly issues in SARS and credits. And here we're saying, we're trying to reassure the diaspora that, don't worry, you'll be able to claim your tax credit. And yet, I personally, and I think many South Africans, don't have confidence that SARS are dealing completely fairly with regard to tax refunds and tax credits. We heard the story yesterday about tax credits, SARS simply raising debits to offset these tax credits, to the cent, the exact same amount. So, I mean, I know that's a different story where someone's paid twice. It's not quite the same as what we're talking about here. I understand that. But what I'm trying to say is that for us to get the complete assurance that those tax credits will be taken into account immediately. And so Erica has raised the question as to why that shouldn't be built in somehow into the legislation. I think is a very valid one, and I would really ask that perhaps in the drafting of the final bill something be taken into account there. I should have been paging while I was talking, but I'm male and I can't multifunction, I'm told. Certainly that's the view of my wife. And I love her dearly. Yeah, I'd love you to do that. Mr. Chairman, France mentioned a comment is when the bank spots something. You know, I assume, you know, I'm not sure what this all means. I mean, no one wants fraudulent refunds paid out, but actually SARS themselves are doing a pretty good job of blocking refunds. They don't need the bank's help here. So if the SARS has now gone through all the processes, and then the bank then decides for itself now to do this, well, there I think you've rejected that. What exactly is the bank looking for that may not have been seen by SARS beforehand? What exactly is it? I don't really understand. And then, you know, there's this two-day rule. I mean, we heard again yesterday how stoppers are put on refunds and they sit there for months. In one case, I think we were told 2 years not being lifted. And we just can't rely on SARS at the moment. So, okay, there's a 48-hour, 2 days, and the bank will lift it. I assume that's not going to rely on SARS at all. And so you have a comment like, and the response, only when a bank reasonably suspects. I don't know what that means. It really, you need to help me there. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, just to make some things clear, from my side, I mean, at this stage, colleagues, we are obviously looking at issues broadly, not a text of a bill, right, because it's not formally tabled. But I think I would like to ask, Tandi's taking over, for members to consider there are some issues that we can, in broad policy terms, signal here at today's meeting, where we stand, because the stakeholders are here and they can hear. For example, Comrade Tandi and others.
There's two stands, that's the only two members who are here.
Yeah, well, and you. What I'm saying, comrades, is obviously just to inform the stakeholders that Gloria and Antonio. Where's Antonio? Yeah, Zakiele has actually been working on the report, right? So he's excused. But both of them were there. Gloria gave us an overview for about 15 minutes on her take and PBO's. Dumasani is somewhere out of Cape Town, right? So he was also there on behalf of PBO. Antonio, do you want to say anything about your short? Okay, and Zakiele will do some written work around it. So what I'm saying is that, for example, Comrade Tandi, this issue about exemptions for foreign South African workers, I mean, I can't see what more Treasury could do, and I think broadly one should agree with what's there. So that's one thing I'm signaling. On the bargaining council, we need to do a bit more work. But broadly, again, I mean, my own view for what it's worth, it's not been taken to our respective party political study groups. It's something we need to give serious consideration to and tweak. You're meeting again, and you'll come back to us on your pending meeting. But the others, it seems to me, largely, that one will be sympathetic at this stage, I'm stressing. What we need to do is engage more with our officials, our official staff, parliamentary staff, PBO, Dumasani, Antonio, and Zakiele, and have more discussions with Treasury. But I'm a bit encouraged, Comrade Tandi, from where we were to where we are now. So that's my own view, but hey, you can feel free to say whatever you want.
Before you reach, I want to make it clear to the meeting that I missed the public hearings on the TILAP, so I will not express any opinion because I don't have a clue what was said there. I'm going to do just the technical direction of listening to the two members and whatever they say. The secretariat will note it, so I've got no role to play today. Just to say you, and that's it. So my job is very easy. Thanks. As I said, I have no clue at all, so I don't know who needs to speak now.
Okay, I can start with some of the responses on the foreign income. The first one was that it looks as if we're being quite generous. What about moving the days out to 3:30 along with the income exemption? So we thought about that. In the last meeting that we had here, the honourable members did put forward a concern about the impact of those on lower incomes. We felt that if we moved the exemption out even to, say, 3:30 days or 3:20 days, you would still get lower income South Africans who were working abroad that weren't out of the country for that long that would then be hit immediately, and they wouldn't have a 1 million exemption. So we were just worried that, you know, if there was a teacher that was out for 250 days, then they wouldn't get the 1 million exemption. So then they'd be hit quite hard. Also, if you then had 250 days for someone in the UK, perhaps they would have to do top-up payments. So that's why we kept the 183 to try and do it. Maybe we are being a bit too generous. We're not sure. We'll have to think about it. The question on... Yeah, I apologize. Maybe I got my wording wrong. You're not using the credit overseas. So it's if we have this exemption, then you'll be, if you're in the UK, for example, you'll be paying tax in the UK. But now you add the amount to your taxable income in South Africa above the exemption, so only amounts above 1 million. Okay? And then you'll end up paying tax on the amounts above 1 million as because it's taxable income in South Africa, and then you can use a portion of the tax credits that portion, you can have a foreign tax credit, which is given by a portion of the taxes you've paid in the UK, to offset the tax here. Am I clearer? Does that make more sense? So we can discuss afterwards if I said it slightly incorrectly, but that was the idea. Why can't there be an explicit legislative provision to avoid double tax on the pay-as-you-earn side? I mean, we can discuss that aside. Maybe we can. We thought there was a provision in there already that would cater for it. If it's going to be difficult, we can look at that again. And then on the foreign pension, it's a treaty issue so that foreign pensions paid by another government would almost always be tax-free. Like, it would be very difficult for us to not be tax-free. The interesting thing is that foreign pensions paid from private retirement funds at the moment are tax-free. Just saying that. But those wouldn't be a social security contribution, so you couldn't get any. Anyway, just saying that. And I think that's everything on the foreign income.
Do you want us to know that, Professor? No, you said it's a gap. That's why I'm asking.
The next one was...
I don't see any member of the secretariat, so I don't know who's noting it for later discussion. Antonio is also gone. Gloria, it can be nice to ask. Oh, there's Antonio. Did you hear what was the response and the issue that has been flagged for later discussion? Oh, thank you. I did indicate that I'm clueless. Just pardon me. If I lose one meeting, it takes me 5 meetings later to understand what you. I'm not so smart, you know. So I know this issue on overseas credit is going to be with us for a very long time. It's not a new issue. I'll relate to it at a later stage. So don't think I'm running away from it, Momo. I'm just collecting my thoughts very carefully. And there's a lot of interested parties, you see. So and you know where I stand in relation to creating revenue. So there's no secret about it. But I'm not going to express any opinion today until we make peace with everybody. I'm a peacemaker. You see, I want Peter to see everybody to smile. But even if they don't smile, at least half smiles. They work sometimes. So. You understand, it's a very difficult, it's a very complex thing. We need to make people sometimes to understand the difficult decisions that you need to take. So I'm not trying to run away, I'm just thinking deeply. And I'm very slow. I take very long when I try to think this over, because it's the only gist of the matter in the whole context. So don't think just because I was not there, I don't know that issue. So I know it's the only issue that brought everybody in this room. But I handle it differently from the chair, you see. Unlike him, I represent too many sectors. And then those sectors must all be happy in one room. Very difficult. So we'll see how far it can be pulled. Because, you see, the man who takes in charge cannot do it the way I do it. I take too long to deal with it. But I want us to know this one so that we get to understand where Honorable Liz is coming from, so that we wrap it properly as we come there. Is there any other view that needs to be expressed on this matter? Are you, Ayanga, you want to? Okay.
This is not the foreign income.
Yeah, but
okay. The second issue that Saika asked is consultation process. There was a workshop. How does it fit now into this process? In terms of the process, this is a draft response document in terms of the draft bill. From here, we're going to meet with the industry, and we'll make changes as proposed in the draft response document, whereby we say accepted, we have to make changes, whereby we say noted, whereby we say we're going to meet with the industry to find the ways, that's what we're going to do. And then from there, the bill will be changed before it's tabled in Parliament. We foresee that it will be tabled during the MTPPS. It will be introduced by the minister during the MTPPS on the 25th of October. The minister has announced that. So what is happening is that This is a draft response document. After the bill has been tabled in Parliament, taxpayers do come to Parliament sometimes, maybe last year, and then they propose changes in the bill after it has been tabled. Frank Jenkins was here in the past 2 years. And then what we do, changes, the bill does no longer belong to us once it's tabled. It belongs to Parliament. So if you want changes, you have to write a letter to Parliament to request changes in the bill that has been introduced. So that is done in terms of the Money Laws Amendment Bill process through Advocate Frank Jenkins.
We don't want to encourage, people have their rights, so they can do all of that. We don't want to over-encourage that. I think the issue, Chair, at the end of the day, there's an element, you hope it's not big, but there's an element of coercion behind any tax, okay? Where the state is forcing you to pay. Obviously, you know, if you could have your way and you're used to not paying, there's resistance, okay? I worry when people praise the Treasury that we've heard, then I think were we not firm enough, okay? Because we certainly don't want to be captured by any interest group. And that's the issue here, is that, you know, one's got to hear what people are saying. There is an element of a judgment call. I think the issues that are raised, that with the tax system, there are issues that it needs to be equitable, that if you, like when we're dealing with bargaining councils, dealing with a category of people this way, what happens in the future? But, you know, we've already had a special VDP, we've got a VDP, and we've had a special VDP, so we do sometimes look at categories of people, but that, I don't believe that makes it unconstitutional. Yes, every amnesty or VDP sets a bad precedent in the sense that, it means that the people who complied are now almost disadvantaged compared to the people who didn't comply and find a way of getting back into the system. Now, I don't think those are unconstitutional, but I think those, it's not something we want to do all the time, but they need to be argued, but obviously they do set precedent. So there's no easy answers to these things. I think they are difficult and complex issues, and somehow you hope through this process that what comes out is a reasonable way forward, taking into account the objections that people have had. You sort of almost hope that everyone is equally unhappy at the end of the day, and proportionate to, that must take into account people have a lot of money to lose, they might be the most unhappy. But yet, sometimes it's a small amount lost by ordinary people that you have to take into account as well. So, yeah, do you want to deal with bargaining council?
I think there's this issue of inequity. And then, and bargaining councils, we're going to meet with them. From the workshop, there are a lot of inconsistencies regarding the tax application. So if now there are inconsistencies, how do you apply the current rules like the VDP? So what you are saying is that we're going to meet with the bargaining council. They are submitting information to us. So from there, we're going to see the inconsistencies and then the way that they have been applying the law. Because if there are inconsistencies, we have to deal with the inconsistencies moving forward, not currently. That's why we're saying that this relief will assist, because if there are inconsistencies in the tax treatment, the relief will assist, but moving forward, you're going to clarify how the law is applied. I think that was the second issue. Another issue, CFC meeting is going to happen. And then the issue of share buybacks and dividend outside, I think we can discuss that, but that was as Momo has said, that we cannot make everyone happy. You've welcomed our approach in this. We've taken your comment, but we cannot make everyone happy. And then on the group relief for domain companies, we said it's going to be restricted. The group relief will be restricted to domain companies. That was the proposal we have in the bill. That proposal will stay. I think France will answer the issue.
I'm going to start on the VDP so that Momo can see the difference in views between you and Yanga, and who's the most steadfast on it. on dealing with, because when Mom was speaking, you know, it was something like playing in my mind on how accurate you were on how you're going to deal with it case by case, and because we shouldn't lose that message and create an impression that because this dispensation was created, people were not found wanting. People were found wanting, but a specific dispensation was put in place to try and make them. And that message should always give courage to those that were compliant. If it was my will, we should have even gave a small incentive to those who were compliant just to pep up their egos and see that you're doing very well. So, but I'm not in charge. You see, we need to grow the economy. So I can't speak like this. No, I can't speak like this because we need more money. I don't know where we're going to get it. So, but giving a 0.5% to them, it won't kill the fiscus, especially with the savings that were made that the commissioner spoke about yesterday. You might want to consider that. Sometimes you need to know how to play this game to be on top of it all the time. Franz, it's your turn.
Thank you, Chair. I think the points made about which MoMA has already made, which are also in the written response about being cautious about these special reliefs, are very well made. You don't want to do them often because they do have an impact on taxpayer morale. So if you do it, it has to be very carefully considered. The reason Kyle Mandy made the comment about me being happy about the Tax Administration Act is because it's usually people say, you know, horrible things about us in the Tax Administration Act. So it was nice to have someone actually commend the Tax Administration Act for this purpose. I would point out, though, that writing a debt off in terms of the Tax Administration Act is not an easy process. And given that it would come at the end of a sort of audit and dispute process, which has also been proposed, that could be quite a lengthy period of time before that was all done. So those are also things that need to be considered if you start looking at the alternatives. The question was asked about what risks do the banks detect that SARS don't. Well, the banks each have proprietary risk detection models. Now, speaking as a consumer, and a number of times the banks phoned me up and said, we picked up the suspicious transaction on your credit card. Was it yours? And I go, absolutely not, it wasn't. They seem to work quite well. And they don't share those risk models with us. Those are, as I say, very proprietary. They are primarily to protect the bank against loss. So they're not going to be sharing them with other people very easily. And one of the side effects of those models is they pick up things we miss. And that's what this is about. They also tend to be fairly significant amounts that they're picking up, again, given the focus that they're placing on why they have these models in the first place. Now, the question was, what does reasonably mean in this context? Now, if we'd simply said suspects, the question would be, well, how strong does that suspicion have to be? Can it be just a trivial suspicion? Does it have to be a cast iron suspicion? And reasonably is the legal way of putting you in the middle. It sort of says it can't be trivial, but it doesn't have to be cast iron either. It's got to be what a reasonable bank would suspect. And so if it were to be applied to an individual, some of us here may remember the person on the Clapham bus, the reasonable person, or as it was in the time when those decisions were handed down, it was the reasonable man, because that was the way the world worked back then. So you'll notice I have been much more gender sensitive when I refer to the concept. The question about stoppers is not applicable here, because this is the bank, so it is a 2-day period maximum, and then that's the end of the story. The bank releases the funds. So what happens during those 2 days? Well, SARS may look at the case and say, actually, we understand why you're suspicious, but we have no problem with it. You may release. SARS may look at it and say, we have shared suspicions with you. We, in fact, see that is a fraudulent refund, and we therefore instruct you to repay the amount to us. Or nothing may happen for the 2 days. And then that, if that's your sort of fallback or last resort-ish case, and then at the end of the 2 days, the hold would lift.
So, as I say, your sort of last resort outcome is that it's lifted after 2 days. If the system is working, something else will happen during the 2 days. It either will be lifted by SARS, or SARS will in fact instruct the amount to be played over to SARS. So.
Chair, before you get in, I needed Franz to explain what he wants to explain, that actually if there is a position where you need to transact in an emergency situation, the bank doesn't stop you from doing that. That's what you once said, isn't it?
So, I'm not sure in what context that would be. Because in this particular context, the bank holds the account in respect of the refund. So you can't take the refund out and send it somewhere else.
Only in terms of the refund?
Check that. I see my colleagues consulting in the back. But that's the focus of this proposal.
We will discuss this further, because I think the question that you ask is an important one. But essentially, let me say, you know, this is a very narrow area that SARS is acting, and I guess your question is it should therefore be restricted to the amount, okay? This is something we've been engaging with some banks on when it comes to illicit flows, when it comes to anti-money laundering, or even when a student hits a jackpot and gets 14 million rand, okay? That banks' risk systems will, I would guess, will pick up that there's clearly a problem. Of course, their dilemma, as France has outlined, is if they act and they block, they can be sued, okay? Or if they have an important transaction and there's a delay and things, you know, get spoiled because of this, they open themselves up. So banks will be very cautious about acting. On the other hand, you know, when I've spoken to banks, they've, you know, at least one bank has said to us, look, we often see problems, and I wish we did have the power just to delay. Some of it relates to Ponzi schemes. Okay. Now, in a way, whilst this is a narrow issue, I'm just saying this is also a broader issue, because from the anti-money laundering or illicit flows issue, the issue is, should banks have this power? And to the extent that they do, how do you know there's no abuse? Okay. And what's there to protect the customer if it's legitimate? Now, don't have answers, but I think what France and them are asking for is pretty narrow, but I want to also maybe just for us to have a discussion just to look at in a broader context. But like he says, you know, banks actually see a lot of things. And yes, if they didn't reasonably suspect, there are other provisions where they would get punished as well, in theory. But you know, will the authorities be reasonable when they enforce? That's the other issue. Although currently it looks that the risk is the other way. But anyway, let's...
Honorable, I also wanted to have a comment, but I'll take it.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I mean, I think Momo is closing on the right note, because France is saying that it's 48 hours, SARS does nothing, it gets unblocked. Great. SARS says, no problem, release it. The third option is the problem. SARS simply automatically say, no, block it, we want to look at this. And then 21 days, 2 years goes by. Well, SARS asks for documents and goes through this whole long process that was explained to us yesterday. There's a very real risk of that. So it's not true to say that it doesn't relate to stoppers. It's a very similar thing. The stopper is done by the bank initially, but it's immediately put in place by SARS. And then we run into the same old problem. If SARS chooses to. So it's not quite the same. And Momo, I mean, I know that illicit flows and all that, but we got the FIC, and the bank is forced to report there. I mean, it's not like the bank has completely no obligations to to look into these things. And so if we're going to have this 48 hours, then I'm very, unless we get more assurance about the way SARS deals with these things, given the report yesterday and given the 2 years of complaints that I've been dealing with, then we won't be happy about this, because the reputation of SARS is now not clean. And until that happens, until we get that back to where it was, there's going to be this unhappiness about it.
Yeah, Momo, you see, my comment is this. The difficulty of having discussions when at the back of our mind we have issues or particular issues in mind, the limits to broaden the scope of our thinking. And it's a serious limitation because, you see, and I wanted to amplify the point that France was making. In actual fact, my experience with the protection models of the bank is not necessarily only when they deal with significant amounts of money. You know, I've got a very small little savings account. Every time there's a transaction or non-transaction, the bank makes me aware that they're aware that I've changed the way I do what they get used to. If I move money into it, whether it's very insignificant, they say, oh, you know, we can see you've moved money in this one. And if I don't transact for 3 days, they say, no, but she should be hungry. Why today she's not doing anything? She's sick. They try to find out where you are, you see. It's, but the thing is, we need to understand that when SARS wants banks to act on a particular matter, they must give sufficient reasons that can stand the test of time in a court of law. Because reporting to FIC cannot be the only limit. And I'm responding to my colleague in a way, so that, because I'm saying, you see, when we discuss with something that happened in the back of our mind, it limits legislation. Because here we're dealing with the issue at a broader level. And we will assume that there's never been a specific experience. That's the benefit of doubt that you get to give. But he raises the fundamental issue about the time. If it drags for 21 days, then it becomes unfair to a client. So how do we couch it to accommodate? That's why I asked that the earlier question, that it will only relate to the refund, so that you don't block the entire system. So if a person needs to transact, they can still transact, but the query will relate only to the refund and matters that relate to taxation. So if it's as explicit as that, then we don't have to worry even about the events that took place in SARS, because we know that any query will relate to tax matters, not beyond that. As to how much you had in your account before and so on will not be affected. So I think what I said, try to allay those fears. But I think you'll find a way of making it to accommodate all concerns that has been raised without wanting to tamper with the current system. Because I appreciate the current protection systems that the banks have. For instance, I'll give you another anecdote. The other day, I got a call because somebody posed as me in a bank in Montague Garden. And the bank said, did you go to that bank? And I said, I don't go there at all. So they can pick up. The systems are so good that they can pick it up. But it doesn't mean it's not subjected to abuse at some point where any... And I wanted us to move away from the notion that it's only when it's significant amounts, even insignificant amounts. They acted on insignificant amounts. But we don't want a situation where SARS will be taken for litigation because they have actually pushed the banks to do beyond just due diligence in relation to their own work, and the process become cumbersome. So, France, can you try to answer to that so that...
So I think your point is well made. I mean, when they look at my credit card, it's not very significant amounts either. But here they're taking a step more than simply checking with you. Here they're taking the step of putting a hold. So this means they need to really think about it. So it's not merely a matter... So, I mean, just to, again, relate to personal day-to-day experiences, I've had cases where they have essentially SMS'd me or phoned me and said, look, there's something suspicious, could you tell us about it? There have been other cases where the amounts have been bigger, where they've in fact stopped my credit card account until I have come back to them. So, again, because that's a riskier step for them to take, because if they stop it and I get my card declined at the fancy restaurant where I'm taking my partner because I'm trying to impress her, clearly I'm going to be very unhappy with them. So we always try to impress our partners. So there we have a situation where on a personal level you see the distinction. And that is true here. Now, I mean, Mr. Lees makes the point about refunds. And, I mean, obviously if SARS takes this amount back and audits it, we're back into that whole cycle where, again, a taxpayer can complain to the Ombud and SARS can once again, if it's done something wrong, appear in front of the committee and try and explain ourselves. But there's another side of the coin, which is because this exists as a safety net, if it didn't exist, you could see SARS trying to be even more cautious about making refunds because there is no safety net. So now it has to try and identify all the fraudulent transactions. So there's a different way of looking at it too. The fact that this safety net exists means SARS can be, and we can debate how much, can be a little bit more relaxed about how it releases refunds. So again, that's another part of the equation you need to bear in mind. Obviously, I can't speak to the discussion you had yesterday. I wasn't here. But clearly it's raised concerns. But it's all part of a much bigger picture, is what I think I'm trying to say.
Madam Chair, this is an ongoing debate, but I just want to make it absolutely clear that there's a huge difference between the bank phoning me and said, did I go and buy that new Maserati? And the bank phoning, blocking and giving a third party the decision of whether, in fact, I did buy the Maserati. And I did buy it, but now someone else is going to decide whether I bought it or not.
Now it's becoming complicated for my ability to comprehend.
We'll look at this. I think I understand the concerns that members have raised. I think we'll look at it. Come back and we'll talk to our colleagues at SARS. Yeah.
My colleagues have just pointed me at the legislation, which is always a good thing to do. It's in respect of the amount. So it's not the whole account, it's in respect of the amount.
Remember, the amount is not yours up until it's verified that it belongs to you again. That's the other aspect that you are not. It is in a bank account, but until it's verified that you deserve it, it's not necessarily counted as your earnings up until the matter has been there. I think you are trying your luck, Honorable Liz. He's pushing his luck very far, And you know, to this extent, we can apply legal principles, then it will not work. You see, that's why I murmured at the beggar, say, is he speaking as a taxpayer or as a tax consultant? And then I remembered that he represents both, but I don't want us to go there. Today I want peace, no fight.
Yeah, I have to dash off, but let me say, we also got to watch France that... if people know you have this power, then everyone, when they get a refund, will take it away quickly because they're worried in the next 48 hours SARS could act, so it could have perverse outcomes as well.
Madam Chair, of course, the other aspect is the fact that SARS have anything to do with the legislation that they're going to impose.
We should put it in the account when we are very sure that it's deserved. Maybe it will capture the spirit. By the time it gets into your account, nobody should come and query and say, you didn't deserve that, because I would have used it. Somebody tried to use 14 million as quick as they can. So, I mean, really, it's human nature. Early Christmas, you use it as quick as you can. So let's assume in this context, SARS will not be found wanting. I know it's not enough to get their word on the list. You want more than that. Maybe, I don't know what type of a thing can we put that. Yeah, I'm trying very hard. I don't know what else to do. Okay. Oh, thank you. It brings us to the end of the discussion, isn't it? I was not given any brief that we should engage on any other matter. So I take it that then it brings us to the end of our meeting. Thank you very much for bearing with me. And have a thank you and have a wonderful afternoon.
Okay. No, I have like four, so maybe Sunday, Monday. Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah, done. Let me just save it.